Welcome to The Deep Dive, the show that helps you get truly well-informed. Today we're stepping into, well, a potentially tricky area, business structures. Specifically, what happens when two or more people decide to team up? If you've ever wondered, you know, how these shared businesses actually work or what you really need to know before jumping into one, then this is definitely for you. We're drawing from a great source today, Partnership Accounting, Concepts, Capital, and Profit Distribution. So, our mission today, we're going deep. We're looking at the core principles of partnership accounting. Think of this as your guide, yeah? Your essential guide to how these business relationships are legally set up, how agreements structure them, and maybe most importantly, how the money flows, profits, losses, individual partner accounts, we're covering it all.
Exactly. And the aim here is really clarity. Clarity on the mechanics behind these shared ventures. Because honestly, understanding this stuff isn't just for accountants. It's crucial for transparency, for fairness, for making sure everyone's treated equitably. It really underpins the whole relationship.
Okay, so let's start right at the beginning. The why. Picture this. You're running your own show, a sole proprietorship. You're passionate. It's growing. But maybe you're hitting some limits. Perhaps you need more capital than you can raise alone. No. Or, you can't wear all the hats anymore. Management's becoming overwhelming. Or maybe just the sheer risk, carrying it all yourself. It's a heavy burden. Have you ever felt that way?
Mm-hmm. That feeling is exactly why partnerships often come into play. A sole proprietorship is simple, yes. But those limitations, capital, management bandwidth, risk, they're very real. So a partnership emerges as, well, a solution. It's fundamentally about two or more people deciding to join forces. They pool resources. Capital, maybe different management skills, they share the risk, all aiming to run a business together and share the profits. And the whole thing is built on an agreement between them, mutual understanding.
Okay, let's unpack that agreement idea. What's the sort of formal definition we're working with here? Our source points to the Indian Partnership Act of 1932, and it defines a partnership as the relation between persons who have agreed to share the profits of a business carried on by all or any of them acting for all. Obviously, that's specific legislation, but it highlights principles like agreement and mutual agency that you see echoed in partnership laws pretty much everywhere. It gives us a solid starting point.
That definition really is the foundation. And when you look at the nature of a partnership, you see why it's so distinct. First, you need, well, two or more persons, minimum of two. And often there's a maximum, like 50 in India under current rules, just as a practical limit. Second, there have to be an agreement. It can be spoken, just an oral agreement. Honestly, a written agreement is so much better. It just heads off so many potential arguments down the road.
Avoids the he said, she said situation later on.
Precisely. And this agreement has to be for carrying on a business. You can't just form a partnership to, say, co-own a piece of land you're not actively developing or using for business. It needs that commercial purpose. Then, obviously, there's the sharing of profits and, importantly, losses, too. This can be equal sharing. Or it could be based on some ratio they've agreed upon. But maybe the most unique feature is this thing called mutual agency. The idea that the business is carried on by all or any of them acting for all. What that means is each partner essentially wears two hats.
Two hats. How so?
Well, they act as a principal for their own part, but also as an agent for all the other partners. So think about it. Any single partner can potentially bind the entire firm through their actions when dealing with outsiders.
Wow. Okay, so that mutual agency thing.
Oh, yeah.
That sounds incredibly powerful and maybe a little scary. Like if my partner goes out and signs a terrible contract, I'm stuck with it too.
That's exactly it. You are just as bound as they are. It's a huge level of trust and interdependence, which leads directly to the next point. Unlimited liability.
The big one.
Yes. This means partners are jointly and severally liable for all the firm's debts. And crucially, this liability isn't limited to the business assets if the business can't pay its debts.
Creditors can come after your personal assets, your house, your car.
Potentially, yes. Your personal wealth is on the line. This is probably the single biggest risk factor people need to understand before entering a partnership. It's not just business anymore. It's personal. And related to this, a partnership typically has no separate legal existence. It's not like a company, which is its own legal person. The firm can't own property in its own name, usually. And if a partner joins, leaves, or sadly passes away, it legally changes the partnership structure. There's also a really strong expectation, legally and ethically, of utmost good faith. Partners owe each other honesty, full disclosure of relevant information, true accounts, no secrets, ideals, or profits.
So transparency is key.
Absolutely. And finally, there's usually a restriction on transferring your interest. You can't just sell your share of the partnership to a random person without the other partners agreeing. They have a say in who their future partners are.
Okay, so pulling all that together.
Mm-hmm.
If you're thinking about a partnership or you're already in one,
mm-hmm.
what's the big takeaway? Seems to be this deep interconnection legally, financially.
Exactly. It's profound. Shared fate, shared risk. Which is why, going back to the agreement, formalizing everything is just so critical.
Right. And that brings us neatly to the partnership deed. This is the document, the written rule book for your specific partnership. We've heard it can be oral, but honestly, why risk it? Putting it in writing avoids so many potential headaches down the line. It's your chance to agree on the rules before any problems crop up.
Absolutely. The deed is where you nail down all the specifics. I mean, the basics, obviously. The firm's name, partners' names and addresses, also the type of business you're running, where it's located, and the start date. But then you get into the really crucial financial stuff. How much capital is each partner putting in? Are there limits on how much partners can withdraw, you know, their drawings? That needs to be clear. And then the big questions, how are profits and losses divided? Is there going to be interest paid on the capital partners have invested? What about interest charged on drawings if people take money out?
So rewarding investment, but maybe discouraging excessive withdrawals.
Exactly. It sets the financial incentives. The deed also covers things like interest on loans a partner might make to the firm, not just their capital. Any salaries or commissions for specific partners. Maybe one partner does significantly more work. That should be agreed upon. It can even outline the division of work. And looking ahead, it should cover rules for valuing the business's goodwill, its reputation and value beyond tangible assets if a partner joins or leaves. How do you settle accounts when someone retires, dies, or the whole firm dissolves?
That settlement part sounds crucial for avoiding messy breakups.
Oh, absolutely. And finally, good deeds often include procedures for maintaining and auditing the accounts, and maybe even an arbitration clause for settling disputes without going straight to court. You're basically writing the constitution for your business relationship.
It sounds incredibly thorough, and you can see how having that up front prevents so much ambiguity.
Oh.
But here's the kicker. What if people just, you know, start a business on a handshake? Or they have a deed, but it forgets to mention something important, like how to share profits. What happens then?
Great question. And the law anticipates this. If there's no partnership deed, or if the deed is silent on a particular issue, the relevant partnership act, in our sources case, the Indian Partnership Act 1932, provides default rules. These are the rules that apply automatically.
Okay, so what are these fallback positions?
Well, first, and this surprises many people, profit sharing. If you haven't agreed otherwise, profits and losses are shared equally. Doesn't matter if one partner put in 90% of the capital and the other put in 10%. Equal shares.
Wow. Okay. What? That alone is a huge reason to have a written deed specifying the ratio.
Definitely. Second, interest on capital. The default is no interest is paid to partners on their capital contributions. Now, if the deed does say interest should be paid, there's a catch. It can only be paid out of profits. If the firm makes a loss, no interest on capital is paid, even if the deed allows for it.
So profit has to exist first.
Correct. Third, interest on loans. This is different. If a partner lends money to the firm, separate from their capital, they are entitled to interest. The default rate is typically set by law, like 6% per annum in the Indian Act. And crucially, this interest must be paid, even if the firm makes a loss. It's treated like an external debt.
Ah. So loan interest is treated more like an expense than a distribution of profit.
Exactly. Fourth, interest on drawings. Default rule. No interest is charged on money partners withdraw. And finally, remuneration. No partner is entitled to a salary or commission for taking part in the business unless it's explicitly agreed in the deed.
So these default rules basically create a very simple, perhaps arguably fair baseline if partners don't specify otherwise. But they might not reflect the actual contributions or intentions.
Precisely. They are a safety net, but relying on them can lead to outcomes nobody really wanted. Hence the importance of a well-drafted deed.
Okay, so we've got the legal structure, the agreement. Now let's get practical. How does the money actually get tracked? You mentioned capital accounts.
Right. Each partner needs their own capital account. This is fundamental for keeping track of their individual stake and transactions with the firm. And there are two main ways to manage these accounts. The first is called the fluctuating capital method. It's simpler in a way. Each partner just has one account, their capital account. Everything that affects their stake goes in here. Their initial investment, any extra capital they add, interest they earn on capital, any salary or commission they're due, their share of profits.
And presumably, Things that reduce their stake, too.
Yes, exactly. Drawings they take out, interest charged on those drawings, their share of any losses, it all hits this one account. And because all these adjustments flow through it, the balance, well, it fluctuates constantly, hence the name.
Makes sense. What's the alternative?
The alternative is the fixed capital method. Here, each partner actually gets two accounts, a capital account and a current account.
Okay, why two?
The idea is to keep the main capital account relatively stable or fixed. Its balance usually only changes if a partner formally introduces additional capital or withdraws part of their original capital. And crucially, this needs to be by specific agreement. It reflects their core long-term investment. All the other regular adjustments, the year-to-year stuff like interest on capital, drawings, interest on drawings, salary, commission, share of profit or loss, all of those go into this separate current account. So the current account balance is the one that's always changing, reflecting the day-to-day financial interactions.
Right. So fixed capital keeps the core investment amount clear and separate from the operational adjustments, which all happen in the current account. Fluctuating lumps it all together.
You've got it. And that difference shows up on the balance sheet, too. Under the fixed method, you typically see both the capital account balance and the current account balance listed. Under the fluctuating method, just the single fluctuating capital account balance appears.
Okay. And you mentioned drawings quite a bit. Can we just clarify what that means in accounting terms?
Sure. Drawings are simply withdrawals by a partner from the firm. It could be cash or it could be goods taken for personal use. It reduces their claim on the firm's assets. There's an important distinction, though. Regular drawings throughout the year are usually recorded against the partner's current account, if using the fixed method, or the capital account, if fluctuating. But if a partner makes a significant withdrawal, specifically out of their initial capital contribution, not just against anticipated profits, that's treated differently.
How so?
That kind of withdrawal, a withdrawal of capital, is debited directly to their main capital account, even under the fixed method. It signifies a reduction in their fundamental stake, not just a temporary withdrawal of funds. The accounting entry reflects that difference.
Got it. So we know how individual partner stakes are tracked. Now, the big one, distributing the profits or losses at the end of the year. You said it's not just splitting the final number on the main P&L.
That's right. After you've prepared your normal trading and profit and loss account to find the overall net profit or net loss for the business, there's usually an extra step in partnerships. This is the profit and loss appropriation account. Think of the main P&L as calculating the total pie available. The appropriation account is where you actually slice that pie according to the partnership agreement and the adjustments we've discussed.
So its purpose is purely distribution among partners.
Exactly. Its sole job is to show how the net profit or loss is appropriated or distributed. It starts with the net profit figure credited to it, or net loss debited, from the main P&L account. Then you make the adjustments agreed in the deed. You debit the appropriation account for things that reduce the distributable profit, but represent amounts due to partners like interest on their capital, salaries, commissions.
Because those are expenses from the firm's perspective in this context, even if income to the partner.
Correct. And conversely, you credit the appropriation account for items that increase the distributable profit because they are due from partners, mainly interest charged on their drawings. After all these appropriations are made, the remaining balance in this account is the final profit or loss that gets divided among the partners according to their agreed profit sharing ratio. That final share is then transferred to their capital accounts if fluctuating, or current accounts if fixed.
Okay, that makes sense. It's a clear bridge between the firm's overall result and what each partner actually gets. Now, you mentioned earlier that interest on a partner's loan is treated differently.
Yes, and this is a crucial point. Interest payable on a loan from a partner to the firm is considered a charge against profit. Not an appropriation of profit.
A charge against profit, meaning?
Meaning it's treated like any other external business expense like rent or bank interest. It must be paid regardless of whether the firm made a profit or loss. Therefore, it should be debited to the main profit and loss account before you even arrive at the net profit figure that goes into the appropriation account.
So it reduces the overall pie before you start figuring out how to slice it for the partners.
Precisely. It's a cost of doing business, not a way of sharing the spoils. Now, sometimes accounting errors happen, and if it wasn't debited in the main P&L, you might adjust for it in the appropriation account, but technically it belongs in the main P&L. It affects the true net profit available for appropriation.
That's a subtle but really important distinction for getting the numbers right. Okay, let's talk calculations for some of these appropriation items. interest on capital.
Right. Interest on capital is usually calculated on the opening balance of the partner's capital account for the full year. If a partner brings in additional capital during the year, you'd calculate interest on that extra amount only for the period it was actually with the firm. So if they added capital halfway through the year, they'd get interest on it for 6 months.
Makes sense. What if they withdraw capital?
If they withdraw part of their capital, not just drawings, then you calculate interest on the original opening balance up to the date of withdrawal, and then on the reduced capital amount for the remainder of the year. Sometimes you might only know the closing capital balance. In that case, there are specific accounting steps to work backward, adding back drawings, deducting profits, etc., to figure out what the opening capital must have been. It's a bit of a puzzle, but necessary for the correct interest calculation.
Okay. And what about interest on drawings? You said it's only charged if the deed says so.
Correct. If the deed does require it, the calculation depends on the information you have. If you know the exact amount, date, and rate for each drawing, it's simple multiplication. But often, partners draw money regularly, and tracking every single date is cumbersome. If the deed specifies a rate but maybe not dates, or just says drawings were made evenly, a common simplification is to charge interest for an average period, often assumed to be 6 months, on the total amount drawn during the year.
A practical shortcut.
Exactly, but it gets even more specific if the drawings are very regular, like a fixed amount withdrawn every single month. Accountants have developed methods using average periods for this.
Ah, okay. This sounds like where it gets detailed.
It does, but it's logical. For example, if a partner withdraws a fixed amount on the first day of every month for 12 months, the first withdrawal is in the business for 12 months, the last for 1 month. The average period works out to 12 plus 1, 2 equals 6.5 months. So you calculate interest on the total annual drawings for 6.5 months.
Okay.
If they withdraw on the last day of every month, the first withdrawal is in for 11 months, the last for 0 months. The average period is 12, 1, 2 equals 5.5 months. Interest is calculated for 5.5 months on the total.
And if it's in the middle of the month.
And then it averages out neatly. Total months, 2 equals 6 months. Interest for 6 months on the total. And the same logic extends to quarterly withdrawals beginning, middle, or end of each quarter, or even half-yearly withdrawals. There are formulas based on this average period concept to handle those regular patterns. It seems complex, but it ensures fairness when drawings are consistent.
It really shows the meticulous nature needed to keep partnership finances fair and transparent, doesn't it? Even for something like drawings.
Absolutely. Every detail matters in maintaining trust.
So beyond the regular profit splits and interest calculations, are there other more special scenarios partnerships encounter?
Yes, definitely. One interesting one is the guarantee of profit to a partner.
A guarantee, like ensuring someone gets a minimum amount.
Exactly. Sometimes when admitting a new partner, or maybe to retain a key existing partner, the other partners might guarantee that their share of profit won't fall below a certain level. How it works is, first, you calculate everyone's profit share normally based on the agreed ratio. If the guaranteed partner's share is less than the guaranteed amount, the shortfall, the deficiency, has to be covered.
Covered by whom?
Usually it's covered by the other partners, the ones who gave the guarantee. They make up the difference, typically in their own profit-sharing ratio relative to each other. So our source gives an example. Abin and Sabin admit Mohanlal. Ratio is 3.2.1. Mohanlal is guaranteed ours, 5,000. The firm makes ours 24,000 profit. Mohanlal's 16th share is only RS 4,000. That's RS 1,000 short of his guarantee.
Okay.
So that RS 1,000 deficiency is borne by Abin and Sibin in their ratio, which is 3.2. Abin pays 35ths of the deficiency, RS 600, and Sibin pays 25ths, RS 400. So their final shares are adjusted downwards while Mohanlal gets his full RS 5,000.
And sometimes just one partner might give the guarantee.
Yes, that can happen too. One partner might agree to personally cover any shortfall for another. It raises interesting strategic questions, doesn't it? Why offer a guarantee? Are you securing talent? Managing perceived risk for a new entrant? Buying loyalty?
Definitely food for thought. Now, what about mistakes? You close the books, distribute profits, and then realize, oops, you forgot to account for interest on capital, or maybe charge the wrong salary.
Ah, yes. Past adjustments. It happens. Fortunately, you don't just ignore it. You need to make correcting entries. This is often done through a single adjusting entry directly in the partner's capital or current accounts in the next accounting period. Or sometimes, a specific profit and loss adjustments account is used temporarily to figure out the net effect of the corrections before adjusting the partner's accounts. The goal is to put everyone in the financial position they should have been in.
So you can fix errors after the fact to maintain fairness. Good to know.
Essential, really. And just to wrap up on final accounts, as we said, the basic trading account and profit and loss account look very similar to any other business. The real distinguishing feature for partnerships is that profit and loss appropriation account. It's the crucial link that shows how the operational result translates into what each partner actually receives, incorporating all those specific partnership agreements and adjustments. It separates the business's performance from the partner's individual entitlements.
Right. So after this deep dive, you should have a much clearer sense of the partnership landscape. We've looked at the legal underpinnings, the absolute necessity of a good agreement, that partnership deed, and the nitty-gritty accounting mechanics that track capital and distribute profits fairly. You can see now, hopefully, that a partnership involves way more than just sharing the workload. It's a deep entanglement of risk, reward, and mutual responsibility.
Absolutely. And understanding these accounting concepts, it's not just for the number crunchers, truly. It empowers anyone involved in a partnership or thinking about one to really grasp the dynamics, to spot potential issues, understand the risks, and appreciate why things like transparency and fairness aren't just buzzwords. They're built into the accounting structure itself. You start seeing the trust and the risk reflected in those debits and credits.
So as we finish up, here's something to think about. We talked about utmost good faith being vital in a partnership. Consider this. How does the lack of a clear written partnership deed truly test that principle? Especially when unexpected things happen, a big windfall profit or a sudden loss. Or think about when a partner contributes not just money, but maybe invaluable skills or years of their time. Without a formal agreement spelling things out, how much pressure does that put on trust alone? What does that tell us about the balance between relying on trust and relying on formal rules in the often unpredictable world of business? Something to definitely mull over.